another because we face each other on the pitch, and he beats my ass royally pretty much every time. Other than that, it was nice to have Alex pull me in on this when they got started, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. It gives me a way to explore my history roots in some ways, but also a game that I love.
Dylan Miner, I'm an assistant professor here, trained as an art historian. My interests are in indigenous visualities in terms of sports. I've written on sneakers and masculinity, and I'm doing some other work on visual representation of sport and art. So those are kind of where I come from.
Hi, my name's Ben Smith. I'm a Mexican historian. I've written on kind of politics, also religion, in 19th and 20th century Mexico. My last book was on Mexican politics in Oaxaca. And I'm shifting towards doing a kind of a bigger project on Mexico City, with certainly sports as an element of that, from the kind of 1940s through to the 1970s. So I really enjoyed this particular insight.
Rodrigo, did you want to go, and then Peter, and then...
Sure. My name is Rodrigo Stein. I'm currently in Montreal. I'm a recent graduate from Concordia University in History and Political Science. And my interests have been football and identity, and ways of which football can be used for social transformation and progressive ideas. That's basically my interest and hopefully future research.
Peter?
Hi, I'm Peter Leggi, and I write about South African and African football, and very happy to be part of this group and eager to chat about Roger's book with you all.
Yeah, so before we get into it, I want to thank you again, Roger, for making the time. I think it's something that's gone really well for us in our last two sessions, and it's always been really great to have the authors provide their insights on something we'll spend a lot of time linking into our research. So thank you for volunteering your time. The book Golden and Blue Like My Heart, I read Pablo Alavarez's review, who is a soccer historian in Buenos Aires, and he has some opinions that he voices in the review of how this book fits into the literature. So. Before we start, as we always do, I'd like to give the author just an opportunity to talk about a couple points, and I'm not sure if you prepared something here, Roger, but just to sort of guide your discussion. Most authors have usually talked about the book writing process or how this tangent of sport got started for them in their graduate careers, and also, you know, how they see their work fitting into the larger body of sports scholarship. And just general things that we wouldn't know unless we had spoken to the author.
Okay. Well, thanks for the invitation. I think it's great to be joining the group, and also it's an honor that we're going to be talking about my book today. Just one quick comment on the technological aspect of this. First, just to check if everyone can hear me okay.
Yes.
Coming through clearly.
Okay, but we can't, using Skype now, where there's no video. Is that
right? For conferences, video, Skype does not support multiple video conferencing, which is why we usually use Breeze, but with Breeze going wonky on us, we'll stick with voice.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay, that's fine. I was just wondering if there was something wrong with my video, or whether it was something, whether it's how the Skype works. Okay. Well, to talk about the book. It's a topic that I guess sort of giving the real explanation of why I ended up writing about this isn't something that I put in the book, because perhaps it's a little bit embarrassing. I got into anthropology because I like the sort of anthropological way of thinking, the comparative perspective of anthropology. And when I started the graduate program at Johns Hopkins quite a while ago, and I needed to choose a topic, and I didn't sort of have a burning problem in mind, or even a place necessarily that I wanted to do the thesis research. And so it occurred to me to do something that I enjoy, which is sports, and that's how the idea came to me, to do something on soccer fans. And the idea of coming to Mexico was really just linked to the fact that I had done a short earlier project in the Dominican Republic on baseball, and I was really crazy about the idea about going back there. At the same time, I wanted to continue in a place where I could use my Spanish, and that's how I ended up here in Mexico City. I think things about sort of how I found the Porra and the Pumas, I think I described that in the book, so I won't go back to that. Maybe one thing that I could note is the experience of all this on a personal level. Because I think in a way my research on these soccer fans was an initiation into Mexican soccer, but at the same time really into Mexican society more generally. I mean, I think I learned a lot of things that have been useful to me, not just in an academic sense, but in a practical one. You know, the kind of patron-client relationships that I describe in the book. And also, I guess, becoming a Pumas fan through the process also allowed me a sort of place in Mexican society, you could say. Another thing that I try to get across in the book is that it's sort of hard to be neutral in terms of what team you cheer for here, or not even cheer for, because, you know, you take the example of someone like my wife, who's actually not at all interested in the game of soccer, but if you asked her, she'll answer without hesitating that she's a Pumas fan, which has to do more with the relationship with the other teams than it does necessarily with going to the stadium and supporting the club. And I also think I was sort of lucky that the team that I happened to come across in this research, because really I knew very little about Mexican soccer when I started the research, or about the Pumas, and it was a series of incidences that led me to the Pumas fans. But I think it's been sort of lucky because I think I have felt a sort of natural sort of link with what being a Pumas fans means to them. So I think that's made the work more enjoyable and easier because it's made sense to me. And I'm not sure if the same would have happened if I had done research with the fans of another team. Maybe one other thing that I'd like to mention just quickly, because really what I want to do is hear your comments and your questions, is mention how this has led to another project here with a colleague in the communications department at the Ibero. We decided to try to extend this kind of ethnographic research on soccer fans of one team to teams throughout the country, and we sort of recruited students and colleagues at universities in other cities to do at least a short project on the fans of their teams, and we're bringing those together in an edited volume now with the idea of sort of putting together like a national map of rivalries, which we hope will also help us to understand relationships between cities and regions on a national level. And this is something that I first faced when I was doing this research with the Pumas and you know, visiting their cities with the fans and sort of realizing that this was sort of a way to understand relationships. The rivalries between the soccer teams was a good way to understand relationships between the cities. But anyway, I'll leave it at that. I'm sure more things will come up in the discussion, and I'm looking forward to hearing what all of you thought about the book.
Yeah, sure. Generally, we've done this. I'd like to continue with it. The online participants, I'd like to give the chance to ask a couple questions first, and then we can real live participants ask a couple questions as well. But Peter, if you want to go ahead and ask any questions, and then Rodrigo, but.
Actually, I think I'm going to hold off some of my questions because I have some pretty specific ones, and maybe it's more useful to start the discussion with some more general questions. So I'll pass to Rodrigo and see what he does with the ball.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Perfect. My question is also a bit broad right now. Given to the degree which we hear in the news about the drug wars and everything, and I'm wondering how that has played into football in the national arena, let's say in and defend Preve and so on. Has there been any links between the drug cartel and, let's say, the leaders of the cheering group such as La Preve, and specifically with the murder of Salvador Cabañas? Has there been any links underwater between the drug wars and, let's say, mainstream football in Mexico?
Well, I think Cabañas is still...
Yeah, he survived.
I don't know if he's kicking, but he's survived.
He's survived.
He's not coming to Sunderland, though.
No.
it's an interesting question. I think in terms of sort of having the real data to answer it, because I haven't had the same kind of contact with people in the rebel over the last couple of years when the stuff with the drug wars really got bad, I'm not sure. I mean, one thing that I can comment is that at least the common perception is that Mexico City is actually... probably the safest place in the country, at least in terms of these drug problems right now. So, I think that the problems, the violence that are associated with the rebel and or with conflicts with the barras of America are linked to the sort of older tensions. You know, even sort of one thing that we're finding out, which is sort of interesting, is that gangs and neighborhoods are taking on either the Pumas colors or the America colors as part of their group identity and the way that these conflicts work out in different colonias or barrios. And that's something relatively new, because basically it was much before it was something that was oriented around the space of the stadiums. And now these rivalries have sort of gone into colonias. What I imagine is that, you know, before there were gangs also that had these same kind of conflicts, and now they're just sort of taking on this new form of soccer teams. I don't know if that makes it comparable in a way. I don't know if there's something like that goes on in other places like Argentina. In terms of other parts of the country, and these studies that we've asked colleagues to do, for example, in the north, at least, you know, in places like Torreón or Monterrey or I'm sure Ciudad Juárez, even though we don't have a study from there, whenever violence comes up, it's hard for it not to be imagined to be linked to the question of the drug lords, even if it's not. And so I think that ends up affecting the fans. I think it ends up meaning that sort of very usual fan behavior can produce a very severe reaction from the team or police and so on. But, you know, really sort of connections between, you know, big-time drug dealing and soccer fans, at least up till now, I haven't heard of it. That doesn't mean it's not there.
And if we want to start broad, I have a nice big broad question, and then we can feel free to ask our specifics here. But as a first year studying sport, you know, I had my initial sort of confrontation with Marx and sport as a question of liberation versus hegemony, and I've now, especially in an anthropology course, just something I'll bring up in this question, and other scholarship, I've sort of learned to move a little bit past that dichotomy in sport. But this is sort of a multi-part question. Where do you see your work, A, fitting into that sort of dichotomy, especially if it's not dichotomy? And you discuss the pyramid structure of Mexican society, and a lot of what I've read recently in a lot of my anthropology readings for my course has been some work on theories of value by Graeber and James Ferguson's work on Africa. And Ferguson especially talks about, you know, moving beyond a vertical conception of struggling to advance your own theory of value, right? And his book on Global Shadows, he labels it a horizontal battle that should be now waged. And especially in the conclusion of the book, I found a lot of resonance with how fans justify their ideal even when it doesn't sort of coincide with reality so much. And so in that sort of overall question of where do you see this work fitting into sport as potentially liberating or potentially hegemonic, how do you see sort of the fans that you describe in your book, their ideals fitting in with this pyramidal structure of Mexican society? You know, I didn't find sort of a conclusive statement about if this ideal sort of goes outside Mexican society or if it is strictly contained by this pyramid that you granted problematized in the beginning of your work.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. I think I tend to sort of fall on the side of seeing this something more like, you know, resistance. If we're gonna talk in those terms, which, you know, I'm not so sure that the hegemony is not there. It's just that, you know, I sort of feel like that. Maybe it's my own resistance to an idea of seeing, you know, sort of sport as this opium of the masses and so on, and while, you know, feeling that while that side of things has gotten enough attention, we also need to see what else can come out of this. One thing that I try to get across in the book is that these fans are definitely developing what could be understood as a social critique phrase through the idiom of soccer playing styles and cheering styles. I think that's definitely there at the same time as I try to show, you know, these same guys sort of get pulled into this, the pyramid structure within the same group even. So, you know, to sort of idealize this as some sort of, perfect context of resistance in the stadium, you know, wouldn't be realistic either. So I think it's more sort of trying to salvage something that often isn't taken seriously, which is that the sort of theories of soccer fans, not just of soccer, but of life in general, could be useful for understanding some things in a critical sense. In relation to your question about the pyramid, I think, you know, thinking of the relevance of what they propose beyond Mexico, something I mentioned in the book that when I was, you know, once came across an article about Octavio Paz's romanticism, you know, just by accident, was looking through it, and it struck me how much it sounded like what the Porta members were proposing. I think for me that was the clearest link to things going on in other places. We often, I guess, don't phrase those things in terms of romanticism specifically, but I think in many places throughout the world, maybe particularly the developing world, we could find cases now where supposedly we have situations of democracy and free market and so on, at the same time that those changes aren't occurring as quickly as they are in theory. And also at the same time, while those changes aren't necessarily so satisfactory, and I think that's what romanticist writers were talking about a couple of hundred years ago, and I think that's in a sense what these fans are proposing now. And this would require other research or feedback from colleagues who know these things in other areas, but it wouldn't surprise me if we found similar things in other places. And I think it might be useful to think of it that way because it would help us to fit what soccer fans are doing into these larger frameworks and see it like people have, I think, done with youth cultures now in many studies, see it not simply as an expression of a bunch of frustrated teenagers, but something that fits in quite well with what the most important writers and poets were talking about in the 19th century. So I think that might be a way to take a bit more seriously what our informants are talking about. I feel like there are a number of elements to your questions. I'm not sure if I covered them all.
No, I pretty much answered them. I mean, the only specifics I had, I very much got the gist of taking seriously social action, even when it doesn't fit in nicely to where we think it fits in nicely with power. But I had sort of the only other tangent, which is sort of explored in the book, is in an international sense. I didn't get a clear sense of where that social action lies within sort of a Latin American framework. I mean, obviously they're taking a lot of their cues from Argentina in terms of their behavior. But in terms of relating it to maybe say Zapatismo as having a very international scope in terms of how it aims its social message. You know, I wasn't sure if there was a clear tangent for Pumas fans and how they articulate their.
Yeah, I don't think. Whereas I think they see themselves as borrowing certain things from other places. I don't think that they themselves see it as an international contribution to soccer fandom or something like that. I think it ends up being much more confined to either the rivalries or the problems they face here in Mexico. And so in a sense, you know, it might be through something like the book where it would be interesting for me to see if any of this sounds familiar to people like yourself who know more about the Argentinian case. I was going to ask something else, but I forgot.
No, that's answered my question. Kevin, did you want to?
Oh, I had several questions, and just a quick observation. I know nothing about Mexican soccer, so I was glad to gobble this up. I have two questions, one on your methodology and then another, we'll see how the first one goes. I thought you were spectacularly honest in this book, and in listening to you now, you easily drop into characterizations of how you are transformed by your own experience. And I was never smart enough to be an anthropologist, but I know that as a historian, we don't give up those kinds of transformations very easily as we're trying to make our point. My question to you is how are you a different person after this intensely intimate experience with the Boris? And how might it have changed generally your ideas about soccer in Mexico?
Okay. I think I sort of have to go back to what I think of as part of a long process, which involved, you know, first living here for a year and a half doing the research, and then the fact that since 1999 I've been living here and working here permanently, and you know, so in many ways, although I think one doesn't stop so easily being American or something like that. Often feel that when I go to visit family in the U.S. now, I feel like I'm in a foreign country, and being in Mexico feels like home in many ways. So I think it's sort of how the experience of, well, first the initial research, and then since then being a Pumas fan and continuing to work in this has sort of been an integral part of me becoming Mexican in a sense that I don't know if I could clearly define, but I mean, I think on the one hand, it again going back to these sort of questions of patron client relationships and you know, even though in theory this stuff is supposed to be disappearing from Mexico, I mean, you know, it's just not true. You know, on a daily basis, whether, you know, things that happen to me here at work, or the way that, you know, the sort of parking on the street works in my neighborhood, you know, where the sort of the way that the supposedly public space is sort of controlled you know, first through a series of either valets or parking attendants, and then, you know, how they are connected into authorities or companies that they work for, and you know, the way that you sort of, if you want to get a parking space, how you sort of have to participate in a way in these relationships, either making friends or paying money and so on. And I think it was my first experiences with this were there with the Bora, and if you can recall from the book, a moment in a meeting that we had when the idea was to try to change the president of the group. And it was sort of one of those moments as an anthropologist where the learning is really a bodily experience of, you know, where you're sort of, it was my direct participation and even myself trying to you know, change things in the meeting and seeing the way that my comments were diverted or rejected or made fun of in certain ways, and that I think I sort of really got the feel for the way that control works here in Mexico in these sort of micro settings. And it's something that, you know, whether in you know, parent-teacher meetings at my son's school, even where, you know, the way that the principal of the school maintains control of the meetings, it has a lot of those same strategies that are used that I described there in the book. So, to me, in a lot of ways, it was learning maybe to deal and accept with those things, and, you know, coming from a society where, I mean, I think we have a different idea of the way that individuals and collectives interact. Mm-hmm. So that would definitely be one thing. I think another, not to go on too long with this, but is that I think the Pumas fans' philosophy of this sort of, you know, this idea of passion and coming from the heart and so on, I think helped me to understand something that I already experienced being a fan of not soccer teams, but basketball teams or baseball teams in North America. And I think one thing that was great about what they did was the way that they voiced it, because these were things that I never really, you know, talked about with in such explicit terms, either with my father or with friends or anything like that. So I don't know whether this is something to do with soccer in comparison to the major U.S. sports, but I think one thing that was quite impressive was making it all much more conscious, you know, what we're doing here as fans. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I did, just a quick note, and I want to pass it on. This will give away my age too. I tended to think of the social relationships you described as sort of marginal clashes, much like Wallerstein periphery ideas. I think I was taken in mostly by what I was reading between the lines in your own socialization to the place of this. I wonder too if Mexican soccer is different than any other place in the world, and maybe we can hold off on that, and Peter can jump in too with his experience. But I really appreciated the book. Thank you.
Oh, no, I'm glad. Thanks.
Hi, this is Dylan. My question has to do with thinking about youth subcultures and how kind of soccer fans in the Borra fit into other youth subcultures, because you focus so much on the prospect of youth as it plays itself out within the kind of practice and ideological manifestations of the Borra. But how does that fit? I wonder, my own research is about kind of Chicano and American Indian hip-hop and punk rock, and I've done some work on urban culture, urban kind of youth culture in Oaxaca. And I wonder, how do Pumas fit in with other youth subcultures in Mexico City? And I'm thinking in particular a place like El Chopo, the famous kind of street market where all the punk rockers and metalheads and what we call in the States the goth, but what you call down there, los dark. How does And Los Emos too, the emo kids. How do those youth subcultures kind of differentiate themselves from Puma fans, and how, if at all, do they integrate themselves in one another?
An interesting question, and I think someone who I think the way I dealt with youth there could have been done better, but I guess questions like that can push me to think more about these things. Let's see, the sort of the subculture that these guys in general fit into most closely back in the late 90s wasn't so much things going on at the Chopo. It was more, I guess what you would consider sort of rock music, more international and Mexican. I think the sort of clearest example of this comes from marches of to commemorate the October 2nd massacre in Tlatelolco, when the Pora members would participate, or a lot of them would, and even non-Pora members would sort of mix together chants, sort of political chants, Pumas songs or chants, and rock songs. And sort of, I don't know, a style that one could describe with, having a lot of these guys had long hair, and there really, at least then, really sort of weren't punks or goths or something like that. What I think has happened since then with the tremendous growth of the Rebbe is that it now includes a much wider variety of people, and I, at least from what I've sort of seen at a distance in the styles of dress and so on, I think there are people that would probably might associate with those other kind of subcultures. I think something that still remains powerful is more of something connected, again, I'm having trouble sort of putting a term to this kind of subculture, but connected to a more standard kind of rock music, and a sort of, I don't know, an image of even of the 60s and 68 and so on. It's very common on the Rebel t-shirts to get the image of Che Guevara. And I think that now that they're being more closely connected to these sort of colonia gangs, I think that gets away a bit from this middle class associations with the 68 movement and so on. And you get people that go towards a style of certain kinds of music that would be more goth or punk or something like that. But I still imagine that the sort of hardcores from the Chopo also distinguish themselves from soccer fans. I had a student in a master's thesis on the goths from the Chopo and the bars they go to this and so on, and at least soccer never seemed to come up. They seemed to close themselves off pretty much to that kind of links with other groups. So I don't know if that really answers your question. I probably don't have enough information to really give you a better idea.
No, I think that's great. So when you're thinking kind of like as the rockeros and kind of being part of that culture, are you thinking, I mean, is it bands like Maná and El Tri and Jaguares, that sort of kind of mainstream Mexican rock that these folks are listening to and kind of...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, no,
no one listens to that band. Only the super faces listen to that.
But I also think that, like I said, I think it's got to be a little bit. If it was a little bit for SW4, it's definitely less so. The Rebel nowadays, and I don't know. I think something that again would be it's pretty sort of a superficial observation, but. Even these, a lot of the people that are drawn to things like the Chopo often come from a bit more of a middle class or lower middle class background. And I, I think that there's a way that you know these kids in these working class colonias sort of mix the different symbols up. They can have sort of a punk looking haircut without identifying with a particular group, for example, and it's sort of more of a broader rejection of certain things from the dominant culture that doesn't even fit into these sort of consumer categories so easily.
This is kind of a question that comes to mind from what Dylan was asking. I wondered if you went to a certain punk show, if you'd see a lot of Pumas tops there, and if that kind of association occurs.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be speculating, but I would say no. For punk, no. But I think if you, if you went to a Manu Chao concert, that you probably would.
Maldita Vecindad, isn't that the...
I don't know if that gives an idea of the associations. I don't know. Maybe I sort of this proposal that everyone that you sort of can't be neutral with these in terms of having a team in Mexico City. It would be interesting to talk to the people at the Chopo and see if they fit into that or if they have teams or if they reject it. Soccer lately.
Ben. Hi, Ben Smith, Pumas fan through family connections, although provincial Pumas fans, so I'm not sure if they differ. And I've got kind of, I'm going to be very quick here, also kind of political historian. So the first question is, you mentioned this idea of Mexico as a kind of patron client pyramid. It clearly is a pyramid, but it's not really kind of Tenochtitlan with its kind of clear lines. It's much more kind of Tikal with its kind of shot through with holes and being... in danger of being kind of pulled back into the jungle it was carved from. And I was wondering, you obviously, in the last 10 years or so, sport is a sphere in which relations with the state and with consumer capitalism could be negotiated. I wonder if through your research you've seen this as a constant or something that's been kind of created in the last decade or so. I'm reminded there's a very good article just out in Past and Present on bullfighting in the 1940s and 50s, arguing that it was sports newspapers and sports stadia in which people could actually have a go at the government, particularly because so many government ministers owned bulls. Particularly, I think it was Manuel Avila Camacho's brother owned a load of bulls, and if you want to have a go at Avila Camacho, you would accuse him of having bad bulls. That's bulls, not balls. In actual fact, although that brings me on to my second example, there was a famous bullfighter, Jesus El Tuerto Morales, during the 1950s, and he claimed that he was the only bullfighter who didn't take it up the arse from the patrones who owned the bulls. So by kind of claiming his masculinity, he was the same way kind of accusing the government of being maricones or kind of, you know, homosexuals or not masculine enough. So my first question is, do you see sport as a space as being a constant or being something novel brought up by neoliberalism? The second question is, you mentioned that in the introduction that America, declaring that you support America, is kind of embracing of globalization and global capitalism. I mean, this is only from my own kind of experience in Mexico, but I think you're right, but it's a kind of, and I'm sorry for the reference, it's kind of a Tepito kind of embracing of globalization and capitalism. It's kind of embracing it but undermining. It's kind of pirate capitalism, pirate in a way. And I mean, the most famous player from America is Cuauhtémoc Blanco, and he's, you know, always projects himself as this kind of really working class guy who grew up in the barrio. And the America's fans that I've met are in many ways, you know, as I think you mentioned, actually kind of really working class and self-consciously working class. The third very brief question, I do apologize for this, is I thought it was a brilliant book, really fascinating, and sparked off so many ideas. But so Roberto Bolaño, in his book Savage Defenses, gives a kind of really savage indictment of the kind of 1968 generation of UNAM students as being kind of rhetorically radical, but basically being very easily co-opted. And I wonder if the same accusation could be made you know, of many of these Pumas fans, and I'm just reminded of my own family who all there sit there, you know, supporting the Pumas either in stadia or in their home. And I think every single one of them works for the pre-government in one way or another, or takes their cash in one way or another, legally or illegally. So it struck me that there's a kind of, one could read the support for the Pumas as being, you know, the major problem in a way. The reason that the pre survived in many ways, it was because, not because the pre was particularly repressive, because comparatively it wasn't, but because it easily co-opted people, or it co-opted people rather well. So anyway, that's the kind of, I don't know. Anyway, sorry for those three very rapid and boring questions, sorry.
Great questions. The first one, with if this is something new going on with this consumerism in sports, completely new, no. I think the sort of the whole emergence of television as a major consumer force in Mexico, in a sense, always went hand in hand with soccer and the construction of Televisa to be what it is inseparable from America. These are obviously processes that started earlier on. I'm probably going to get the date wrong, but I think Televisa buys America sometime in the 1960s. Something new. I think one thing that's happened is, this sort of maybe jumps ahead to the pirate capitalism that you mentioned, is that through soccer, I think a lot of the authentic brand names in terms of, you know, equipment, insurance, and so on have entered Mexico. I think this is something a process that I saw there in the stadium in the 1990s with the increase in advertisements on the Pumas jersey and those sort of rotating things they put on the field and you know, Nike appearing on the stadium to give things away all the time. I think that compared to the Mexico import substitution, 10 years before, I think that sort of in terms of these consumer items, it reaches a different level. I think you could even think of the recent, if not death, at least reduction of certain sports. I think bullfighting has decreased in popularity. I may be wrong about that, but it's an impression I get. And baseball. I mean, you know, baseball used to be the major sport in probably half the country, and a lot of it through the promotion from the two major television networks that both owned soccer teams. Soccer's been displacing baseball throughout much of the country, which also means sort of the possibility of international soccer consumption. People, you know, going around in Manchester United and Barcelona jerseys as well. So I think, in a sense, it's changed consumption patterns. I'll leave that there. And then going to the question of America, it's an interesting observation. And America is really, it's sort of tough to put your finger on. I actually have a graduate student now who's doing his doctoral thesis on the American fans, which is sort of interesting because he himself is a Pumas fan, so it's caused some interesting personal conflicts in him. But I think the way that I've understood this is that America fans, in the great majority, are definitely people from the popular social classes. And the way that they're understood in Mexico is as people who to participate in these kind of patron-client relationships and do so in a very willing way, you know, without even sort of trying to hide it, without being embarrassed by it. And, you know, I think, for example, Cuauhtémoc Blanco is considered to be an example of that. His sort of loyalty to Televisa and America, even though he hasn't played for the team for a few years now, combined with his, I'm going to have to use the word that's used here, as being a what people in Mexico City would call a naco, which Claudio Lomnitz has done a good job of describing, I think, as someone who sort of poorly adapts to modernity, in a sense. And so someone who would, sort of use a Manchester United jersey, but sort of use it in a way that, it just didn't quite come across. It would come across as a third world person using this first world piece of modernity. On the one hand, what you're getting there is a bit of class prejudice from either more middle class Pumas fans or people that, in a sense, aren't in that social class but aspire to it. And as I mentioned in the book, there's even sort of a bit of a conflict within the group, differentiating those who are sort of these authentic Pumas fans and those who acted a little bit like Americanistas because they were trying a little bit too hard to be like Pumas fans. But it's an interesting category, the Americanista, without a doubt, because it would be nice if you have a term that wasn't naco, but thinking of something like a colonial dilemma. I mean, I think that's something what in a sense America fans are experiencing maybe Mexicans all over experience, but in a particular way, which has to do with sort of wanting to participate in these things, wanting to get close to power, but in the end, doing it in this pirate style, as you mentioned. And then maybe the last question about this co-optation. Yeah, I mean, the group is definitely riddled with contradictions of that sort. And I think, in a sense, those that most resisted the co-optation really, really suffered in a way, and because there is a terrible amount of pressure, by no means are Puma fans free from this, nor are students at UNAM. UNAM is even considered to be the place where not only sort of future members of the government are formed in an educational sense, but where they even first make the contacts that will later be those sort of segments of the pyramid. Even though it's not as structured as I think with things that go on in UNAM itself, I think the same thing occurs with Pumas fans. In that sense, maybe we go back a bit to the opium of the masses, right? Because they seem to be, Pumas fans seem to be resisting these things and so on, when in fact they're really reproducing it and maybe in a sense not even being as honest as the America fans. Because I think another thing that people will say here is that, you know, everyone is really a closet priista. And maybe another way of saying that is everyone's really a closet Americanista.
Right. That's an excellent answer. Thank you. I appreciate that.
I know Peter has a question.
Okay, no, I've been enjoying the conversation so far. I just want to start by thanking Roger for this book, because it's been on my radar for quite some time, and it was only when it appeared on the Football Scholar Forum list that I finally got down to writing it. And Alex, thank you for making it available to me. And this morning I was lecturing in class in my Global History of Soccer course here in KwaZulu-Natal. South South Africa about hooliganism in Britain and stadium disasters, and I had fresh in my mind Roger's book, and it really came to me during class how much of what we know about soccer fans is truly Eurocentric. And, you know, in some ways that's understandable and it's fine. We've learned a lot from particularly sociologists and anthropologists about European soccer fans in England and the Netherlands, and Italy in particular, and also the Balkans. But, you know, we know a lot less for those of us who are not Spanish speaking about critical areas of the world like Central America and Latin America. So thank you for opening up some new vistas that I think are very necessary to, if we were really to try and get a global understanding of the game. I also like the way in which you try to use the game of soccer to cut across these categories that scholars use so readily, race and class and ethnicity and gender and so on. I found that quite thought-provoking, and I particularly was enticed by the fact that you used youth and this idea of youthfulness as an important category of analysis. I've tried to do a little bit of that myself in my own work. And reading your book, I thought of several new studies on youth and kind of gerontocracy in Africa and how they pointed to a kind of paradox among a lot of kind of young people's critiques and rebellion of adults and even elders. And it kind of creeps into your book a little bit, and I guess this is more of a comment than a question, but I see people like the informants you call Rafael and Gerardo, and I think Daniel at the end, and page 187, as people who in the younger days, you know, were trying to create disorder, madre, and so on, and assailing sort of the establishment values embodied by adults. But on the other hand, they also aspire to become those very adults that they, you know, unless something horrible happens to them, inevitably they will become. And so, you know, these are people who would obviously be very anti-desmadre, you know, people who'd rather stay at home and watch the game rather than go and act like young kids at the ground. So, you know, can you respond to kind of, I guess, the way in which the stories that you tell in about these Pumas fans are in some ways representative maybe of kind of the Mexican urban male life cycle in some respect. That's my first comment. And the second one has to do with some repeated references in the book to sort of generally termed European South American fan styles. And in particular, you refer to the putting your arms around your neighbors on the stands and singing and jumping up and down and trying to get the whole stadium to do that like they do in Europe and South America. Now, I grew up going to games in Italy, and I have never, ever seen the whole stadium jumping up and down, except maybe on one occasion. It was a particularly unique occasion. So I'm wondering whether you're actually downplaying the creativity of Pumas fans in some respects, that they're actually doing something that, you know, if it ever happened in Europe, it happened very rarely. Maybe it happened in South America, but it certainly doesn't happen anymore in the sort of bourgeois spaces that most European stadiums have become. Those are my two comments. I'd like to hear your response on those.
Okay, great. The question of the life cycle. It's definitely true what you're talking about, the way, you know, that I've sort of now, over the years, had the opportunity to see some of these guys change, and, you know, a lot of them don't even want to go to the stadium anymore. When they go, they say, you know, I'm not going to sit with the rebels because I don't like them, you know, telling me that I have to sing or I have to jump up and down. I think at least, you know, from the perspective of these guys who have, in a sense, gotten out of this stage of life, you know, that at least the fortunate ones do move on, and I think their opinion of some of the guys that had originally founded the Rebel and that were still going with the group was that you know, that was a little bit pathetic because they hadn't moved on to different stages in their life. And it was also interesting the way that they ended up sort of changing a bit the way they talked about fandom, and, you know, would now say, well, what makes us authentic fans is, you know, that we've been, you know, going to the games for so long, and wearing jerseys from 15 years ago and so on to sort of show this. Whereas the younger guys continue to say, you know, we're the real fans, we show this passion and so on. So I think that, you know, it could definitely be seen as part of this life cycle and in a sense, part of the way that the pyramid, if we want to call it that, or other structures that exist in society are reproduced. And, you know, in a sense, these guys have this opportunity as young people to be a bit rebellious, but then and they even learn certain organizational and political skills, you could say, through the experience in these kind of groups. And not only that, they learn to connect with people in a certain way. I mean, because whereas America fans sort of connect to people by showing this willingness to be clients, you could say that Pumas fans connect to people by rejecting that. But whereas on the surface it's sort of expressing a certain kind of freedom and individualism, in reality it becomes another way of forming social relationships. Which many times are just as hierarchical as the ones that America fans are. So in a way, in a sense, it's a way that these young people are actually integrated into adult society, you could say. I think one thing that I'd like to maybe salvage there that and say, you know, it's not just sort of the same cycle going on again and again, is the fact that maybe, you know, every generation, or at least certain generations, being in this role where they're sort of outside of well, they don't have responsibilities, at the same time sort of outside the reaches of power for the short time, really do have a moment to express discontent and so on. And I think obviously not a coincidence that young people are often leaders in certain kinds of social movements. And in the case of these fans, and getting beyond the idea of just a cycle, I think that they really did bring with them an important change in what Mexican soccer fandom is, you know, which, as I try to suggest, influences other areas of life as well. And you know, whereas on the one hand, this pyramid is being reproduced. It's also not that simple, but also having changed in Mexican society, I think there really has opened up more of a space for real civil society. And, you know, while you can't exactly credit the soccer fans for that, I think there's a way that these guys played a role in that. You know, it's sort of interesting to see what, you know, how the next generation could is fitting into that, because I think, for example, in the case of the Rebel now, and whereas this stuff is sort of feeding into these barrios and colonias, I don't know, it even has some potential to be, on the one hand, simply creating more conflict in these same colonias, but perhaps also potential to really be something even more revolutionary. I don't know. I'd sort of like to keep those options open, even if what's contributed is small by each generation. What you mentioned about that's interesting to hear what you said about, you know, that that's not something that's done in Italy. It was definitely the perception of these guys who hadn't been to Italy themselves or to South America, that they were doing something that, you know, the real fans in places like Argentina or Spain or Italy do to support their teams. So in a sense, it was a perception of theirs, which I think sort of fits into this post-colonial position of a country like Mexico, where things are given more value in general because they come from outside. At the same time, that there were always sort of insisted on the importance of having a Mexican touch to these things. I definitely think there was an important creativity there. And which involved in a lot of cases sort of not a simple globalization, but the way that sort of certain global youth cultures, or at least the perception in Mexico of certain global youth cultures, were really brought into the into soccer fit in a way that fits in with Mexico. And so that's important to question certain ideas that have come out now that about this Argentinization of Mexican soccer. I think that that's really sort of on a superficial level, and what continues to go on, both the good and the bad, is quite Mexican.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks for the questions.
Two quick questions for you here.
Yes.
Rodrigo, do you want to go ahead? Yeah, go ahead.
Hello?
You're not coming in clearly.
Okay, I have another question. Does it sound better right now?
Yeah, you're good.
Okay, perfect. Just to touch upon more along the lines of media, Televisa is often identified in Mexican society, specifically by Pumas fans, as a tool that reinforces issues of political cronyism and vertical ascension. However, TV Azteca and the other media outlets seem to be abstained from such criticism. Is that a presumption in your opinion?
Whereas I think Televisa is definitely most closely associated with those things, I really think that the distinction has become less important, especially since the privatization of Azteca. A lot of times that people don't even really distinguish now and talk about the media, or I even think sometimes to critique Televisa, Televisa is almost like a metonym for all the sort of major communications in Mexico. And there's maybe as simple as these things still survive, and Pumas fans would probably say they prefer that Azteca was broadcasting their games and not Televisa. But in reality, I think the criticism really, sort of at a popular level, would extend to both now.
Yeah, I had two quick questions for you, Roger. The social structures that you sort of describe, especially at the end of the conclusion, this is what my question was. How aware are the fans of these social structures? And specifically, you talk about sort of the clientelism and democracy that are being rejected by these fans, right? And there's almost a third way here of emotional expression, right? And I wondered how that came across literally in sort of the oral transcripts that you might have collected, and how the fans themselves articulated, clientelism or democracy. I mean, clearly in the Amethyst case, we see the most explicit discussion of what clientelism looks like and what democracy as a veneer looks like. But in what types of terms, and if you want to get into the Spanish, you can as well, but in what terms were they putting it, and how aware of it were they on sort of a political plane? I mean, were you getting sort of lengthy criticisms of clientelism in a Mexican political sense, in a national sense? Were they talking about this as a Mexican problem that trickles down to the border? So that's the first question. Basically, how political are these fans, and how are they putting it in the terms that you've described in the book? And second, at the very beginning of the book, it came up a couple more times, but I'm hoping you can talk a little bit more about it now. But you mentioned that the neighborhoods that the Pumas fans are coming from are sort of the unnamed source of their ideal vision. And it's something that I'm very interested in my research to look at, the urban spaces that these fans come from and how it affects both their support and their political views of their support. So if you could, maybe in discussing, how they talk about clientelism and democracy in their lives in real terms, how also they talk about, where they come from and their life experiences, because it's such a cross-class fan group, as you described, that I suspect it got very messy when you were trying to quantify it with their discussions.
Great. Yeah, more interesting questions. Sometimes I've wondered how much I was clear on this and how much, to what extent I was clear on this, the sort of translation I do in the book from their terms to, terms like, clientelism or patron clientize, which, those weren't terms that people used. But first, just to sort of answer the part of your question where, are they coming up with sort of a critique of, of the sort of Mexican state or something like that? It's really much more on a sort of everyday level, I guess I would say. And which I think in general is how people in Mexico talk about these things. I mean, they're sort of pervasive enough that it's really not conceived of simply as a problem of something that, that occurs out there in the government, but rather something that, every time you want to get a job, these relationships come into play. And so in this sense, they would, how would they talk about this? They would, they would, in their sort of teaching of me, they would say, in Mexico things work this way, they work through relationships. It doesn't matter how good you are at something, you want to get a job, it depends on the relationship. And that's actually a Spanish term they use. People talk about relaciones, basically meaning, something like patron-client ties. Again, sometimes using these sort of more familiar terms like the consentido that I mentioned there,
right.
or the mafia. I think the idea of the consentido shows how sort of pervasive these things are in an everyday sense, because people even relate it to how relationships work in their families, right? Where certain people get privileges over others, not because of what they do, but because of who they are, and how they relate specifically to other individuals. So they would talk about it in those terms. They would, talking about the Pora, about the way Televisa works, they would say it's a mafia. They would say, Televisa favors its consentidos, just as the leader of the Pora favors his consentidos. I think what I tried to do there in the book was to do that translation and to say, just because they're not talking the same terms as political scientists doesn't mean that this isn't what it's about, right? And even sort of use it as a corrective, in a sense, to the idea that, for example, having free elections in Mexico constitute a solution to these kinds of issues. When you see that it's something that occurs, all the time, and not something every, once a year when there are elections. I think that was one of the things that. When I was talking about what I learned about Mexican society, that was one of the things that they got across to me, and that I was trying to convey in this book. And in an earlier article, I sort of make this argument more explicitly, sort of questioning some of the treatments by political scientists, who see these things as political issues in the sense of political. Associated with parties and government and so on, and sort of trying to say that it's much more pervasive than that.
The other question was about neighborhood.
That answers the first question.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah.
The second question regarding neighborhoods, I think you captured it well when you mentioned the sort of the messiness of this when it comes to talking about class in Mexico City. I sort of wonder whether, the same could be said about Buenos Aires or, you know, how much this messiness is something Mexican. And, you know, I think it's something that hasn't been talked a lot about in you know, literature on urban Latin America. And I don't know whether that's because researchers in other places haven't found it, or whether, you know, we've sort of gotten stuck in these ideas about, you know, distinctions between classes or between state and civil society, and we haven't been willing to sort of get the, give those up and be willing to embrace the messiness of things. And I think I also have the tendency not to just to leave things at their messiness. I think that sort of often can often be an easy escape for us is when we're writing to sort of say, well, things are complicated and messy and not go on from there. And so anyway, getting back to the point, I think, again, from the vision of these same fans or people in Mexico City more generally, it's not that social class is important there. It's not that I couldn't identify in the Pora a difference between these guys that were more middle class, that was somewhat related to the neighborhoods they lived in, their parents' occupations, things that were sort of hard to put your finger on exactly. But it was one of those things that everybody sort of knew, you know, in a sense. You know, these class groupings, and not that there weren't sort of, you know, fuzzy lines between them and so on, but there was definitely something there in that sense. And when they would talk about it, it wasn't directly linked to where they lived. It was probably actually most closely related to not even being an UNAM student, because I think the sort of line crossed there, and I think there were these guys that were sort of more middle class that, you know, sort of whatever reason didn't stay in school, and guys that were from more working class backgrounds that had gone on to study at UNAM. And it was almost in their ability to be able to create in the way that this sort of creativity that I described there. I don't know if that's makes sense or if that's convincing as an argument, but you know, maybe even going back to the idea of the Naco, they were sort of the ones who were able to mix Mexicanness and something global in a successful way. They were the ones who were able to pull it off. You know, I don't really know if that, you know, if it doesn't work as sort of a Marxist definition of class, because it's, you know, obviously not very based on you know, relationships to different relationships to means of production and so on. But I think at least in the way that sort of class is experienced in everyday sense in Mexico City, I think there's something to that. But any of these questions, please feel free to push me farther if I'm...
No, that's great.
I know that he cited Hobbes and Long, and I think I was thinking Benedict Anderson, just to follow up on that very quickly. What are the attractive things about considering youth? So I found myself in the margins of the book a few times writing the word freedom, and that the imagined communities that those you describe in this book really center on not being oppressed, and I may be using the wrong word there, but on possibilities, I think is perhaps a more hopeful world. Even though, as an outside observer, maybe they're limited or not, but for me, the games give that space, and that's at the heart of this interest, and that's what allows then for traditional notions of class and how it's manifest to sort of dissolve in the doing of this thing here. I thought it was a very subtle and strong point of the book. And anybody who cites Hobsbawm is okay with me. Does Peter have a question?
I think Peter might be nodding off.
Okay. Yeah, that's lame. Way to hang in there.
Too much red wine, huh?
No, that sounds good. Sounds good.
You must be in the late evening there, right, Peter?
Yeah, it's about half past 10.
Oh. Okay.
Well, Ben and Dylan left, but they both wanted to thank you very much for coming. I found the discussion very helpful in a very practical sense for my research. Peter's on my committees, and we have our meeting coming up here in April. So, in terms of justifying my choosing of sport as a dissertation topic, it's sort of getting to crunch time, and I'm really glad that I had this book to finally take the Football Scholars Forum to Latin America and to start looking at a Latin American team. So, just a very deep thank you for writing the book and for providing the time to have us hurl some questions at you, and all the questions were very insightful. So, thank you.
Yeah, no problem. It's also been insightful for me, and I think a few of the questions I'll definitely keep me thinking. Like I mentioned, we're continuing to do work on these topics down here. I hope to participate in the future discussions of the group. Sometimes we may not be able to. Not that we can't get a hold of the books, but sometimes it's a bit of a slow process. So,
no, I can imagine.
But
I
participate also at least for the Latin Americans, maybe others. I just want to mention quickly a sort of network of scholars that we've put together, mostly in Mexico, but with a lot of people in South America as well. People who work on sports and social issues, particularly soccer, but other sports as well. And we've organized a few conferences here in Mexico. There's actually one coming up in May in Colima. It's actually still an opportunity to send in an abstract if people want more information about that or the network, which just basically means getting your name and your email address added to a list and getting information once in a while. But you're all welcome. The idea is to sort of try to increase the group, which I think is similar to what you're doing here with the discussion forum, and so I hope that we can stay in touch and continue to talk more about these issues through the forum or through the network or other ways.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, if I could give you a call back here in 2 minutes or so, I'd like to ask you real quick about Pablo Alvarez's review, but I just want to say bye to Kevin and Peter real quick. Is that okay? Do you have a second after this?
I just have one last question. Do you know what kind of reception has the book received in Mexico?
Well, these things are always sort of difficult to measure. It was translated and published in Spanish in 2008. It's definitely drawn a lot of attention from the media. I've been interviewed in a number of different radio stations, TV, for newspapers, which hasn't necessarily resulted in the sales that one might think. But of course, as I'm sure all of you working this topic have experienced, a lot of the questions end up focusing on fan violence, which, as the book isn't really about, but that seems to be what he is interested in. So, I often end up saying just that they shouldn't pay so much attention to those questions. I've had the fortune to get some comments from Pumas fans, Porto members. Luckily, they seem to be mostly in agreement about. A few of them have read it and talked to me about it and said that they seem to be mostly in agreement that this describes what they also saw during those years. Some of them weren't so happy with what I said about their treatment of women and said, they didn't remember the incident that I mentioned about the sort of woman being verbally attacked from the bus.
Right.
A few younger Rebel fans have also seemed to have that commented favorably of the book. I mean, I think they sort of see it as a historical reference about their past, in a sense, and also sort of a representation of what it means to be a Pumas fan, or at least a sort of decent effort to capture it. I don't know what
would be interesting to get together, Pumas fans, Amerika fans, Chivas fans, and Cruz Azul fans to talk about the book.
Yeah.
But I haven't had the opportunity to get that yet. But at least it seems to be circulating a bit, the book, so I hope to continue to get more feedback from here.
Great. Well, do you have a second for me to call you back here in a minute, Roger?
Yeah, sure, no problem. If Pete, are you still there, Peter?
I am.
Just one quick thing. This PhD student of mine is actually working on the America, Sergio Varela. He's as sort of a part of a small project we're doing this year on the national team. We've sort of gotten the funds together to send him to South Africa, and he's going to be there during the World Cup, maybe a couple weeks before and after, with the idea of interviewing Mexican fans there. But you know, just sort of mention that. I don't know if you guys are going to be in the same place. I can't remember where the Mexican team is playing, and that's where I imagine he'll be. But I may get him to contact you.
Okay, that's fine. I'll give you my personal email. It's just my first initial P, and then my last name, Alagi@yahoo.com.
Okay.
And I'll be going to the France-Mexico game in Polokwane for sure.
Oh, you got tickets.
Yeah, David Goldblatt actually invited me to go with him. So
that's not a bad invite.
Right at the border with Zimbabwe, so it should be very, very interesting. It'd be a pleasure. I can put him in touch with some folks as well.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Okay, pleasure. Take care, all of you. Thanks so much for the discussion.
No worries. Talk to you soon, Peter.
See you guys.
Okay,
bye.
Thank you, Rodrigo. Bye.
Yep, thanks. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you.